Hi, this is Dr. Linda Mintel. Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast of the Dr. Linda Mintel Show. Our website is filled with more encouraging interviews, all accessible at myfaithradio.com.
It's time for the Dr. Linda Mintel Show.
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome to the Dr. Linda Mintel Show. I'm your host, Dr. Linda Mintel, the relationship doctor. And every weekend, we are here and we're doing life together, and we're glad that you've joined us. My regular co-host, Chris Weigel, is not with us today, but I have a real treat for you. We have Dr. Kurt Thompson, who's revisiting us for a second time, and we're going to talk about his book, The Soul of Shame, because it's such an important topic for all of us to get a handle on how shame works in our lives and how shame impacts our relationships, and more importantly, what we can do with it and how we can heal and grow. Dr. Thompson, welcome again.
Thanks, Linda. It's great to be with you.
I'm glad you came back a second time.
Indeed.
My pleasure. It's not a repeat performance, but it's a continuation of our conversation on shame.
That's right.
Before we get into it, let me remind you who Dr. Thompson is. He's a psychiatrist in private practice in Falls Church, Virginia. He's also the founder of the Center for Being Known, a nonprofit organization that develops resources to educate and train leaders within the fields of mental health, education, business, and the church. And he's all about the impact and the intersection of interpersonal neurobiology, which sounds really important, and it is. It means getting along with people in a very basic way, and Christian spiritual formation. He's also the author of the book, The Anatomy of the Soul. He's a board-certified psychiatrist with the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, and his main clinical focus and research interests have been in the integration of psychiatry, its associated disciplines, and Christian spiritual formation. He is the guy. He's married to Phyllis, who is a licensed clinical social worker, so I really like that about her. And he's also the parents of two children. He's got the child part of this down as well and resides in Arlington, Virginia. His website for more information about him and to check out his podcasts and his books and all the things that he's doing in his Center for Being Known is Being Known, BeingKnown, beingknown.com. That's a lot, but we had to tell him who you were because you have to be known to the audience
exactly.
In order to have them be
otherwise
known.
I'd feel ashamed.
That's right. So give us a quick review, Dr. Thompson, of how shame works in our lives.
Well, fundamentally, we want to remind our listeners that first and foremost, it is an emotion. It is an emotional and physically felt thing. It's curious that it begins early in a child's life, early as 12, 15 months of age, long before they have language. And one of its primary ways of affecting us is the way that it tends to separate us from each other. In the sense that we don't want to look at other people, we don't want to talk to other people, we move away from people. It's an emotional event that separates us from others while it is simultaneously separating different functions of our own personal mind within itself. So, for instance, we talk about the notion in interpersonal neurobiology of disintegration. We all know what it means for something to disintegrate, for things to come apart at the seams, mm-hmm. as it were. If we think about some of the different functions of the mind, we'd say that we know what it means to think, we know what it means to feel, to sense things, to image things in our mind. All of those different features work together as a whole when we are functioning well. But what shame does is that it literally, at the level of the brain and the neurons, those brain cells and how they communicate with one another, they tend to be offline from one another. Mm. Shame is an emotional state that tends to separate the functions of the neurons that represent what I image from the neurons that represent what I think, from what I feel, so forth and so on. It is a disintegrating emotional force that at the same time is also disintegrating or disconnecting or separating me from other people. We can imagine then all the coping that we have to come up with in order for us to then somehow regulate all of this that is going on. we talk about having a shame attendant, this notion that evil is actively using this particular emotional force to literally destroy the universe. It's not just a matter of ruining us as people individually or ruining relationships. It is the way for evil to destroy the creation as a whole, which I think is significant for us because we see that taking place in the first 2 to 3 chapters of Genesis.
Let's move into then how that does influence in such a significant way our relationships and what we do with shame in our relationships.
We can all point to moments in which I feel shame within myself in relationship to another person, and yet I don't want to tell them that I feel ashamed because, of course, if I do, I'm worried that they'll do something that will shame me even further. One of the features that we talk about with shame as an emotional state is that it reinforces itself. I feel shame, and then I feel shame for feeling shame, and it snowballs.
I'm thinking about a husband and wife, and the husband has had an affair, and he's feeling shame for having that affair, knows it's wrong, knows he shouldn't have been doing that. And then his fear about telling his wife, the way she responds to that could reinforce that even more.
We have countless stories of something like that that you've just described, where a very, very powerfully shaming event has emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if we wanted to take the case, and you've seen them and I've seen them, marriages where there's been an affair, no one likes to talk about the affair.
Right.
No one wants to say this is what happened, because the one who is the offending party feels shame for it having happened. The one who's the offended party also feels shame because it has happened.
And feels sometimes they weren't good enough or something they did caused this.
Exactly. So shame is filling the room. The irony and the counterintuitive maneuver that is most likely to bring healing is, in fact, that we move toward it, that we move toward each other by saying, this is what I did, this is what happened, but also to say, I feel great shame over this.
Mm.
One of the things that evil counts on is for us to keep what we say, our words, away from what we feel.
Hmm.
But the moment that I say to another person, I feel shame about this or that, I'm in my brain connecting language to the feeling.
Hmm.
And when I witness someone else empathically, with kindness, hearing me say that, when I am able to feel the shame myself and yet witness someone else not reflecting that shame,
mm-hmm.
it literally changes what's going on neurologically in my own brain.
Which is why it's so important in couples work to help people turn towards each other when there's been a problem like that, rather than turn away from each other, which is what we tend to do. And you pointed out in the last time you were here that a lot of times we turn away and that's how we get involved in addictions or some other kind of coping mechanism. When in fact, if we turn toward each other and then we learn how to have a conversation with each other that doesn't reinforce that shame, and you're really talking about the person's ability then to take responsibility for whatever they're feeling, whatever their behavior is, and even whatever their thoughts are, that whole process of feeling and thought and behavior all interconnected, and having that conversation, it's important how we talk to each other then.
There's no question that at some point, every single one of us reaches that moment where you or I will have to take responsibility for what belongs to me.
Mm-hmm.
No one can make me talk about being ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to do that at some point. But my capacity to do that is deeply affected by the nature of the community in which I reside. That's why we say, I can't all by myself think my way out of shame. It absolutely requires the presence of other people with whom I am actively pursuing relationship and they are actively pursuing relationship with me in deep ways of being known, such that we don't give shame, our shame attendant, or evil a foothold.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about how that happens when we come back from the break. More about The Soul of Shame, the book that Dr. Thompson authored, after the break.
This is the Mental Health Minute. Here's Dr. Linda.
Is every spare minute of your life filled with some activity, event, or demand? If so, you could be suffering from a very common American disease. It's called overcommitment, and it has seeped into every area of our lives. I'm Dr. Linda, the relationship doctor, and yes, I'll admit it, I've fallen prey to overcommitment in my life just like I imagine you have. Saying no occasionally is the best defense against overcommitment. But if it's too late and you're already overcommitted, here's a little tip to help you make it through. In the busiest days, you can still stop and take five just for yourself. When your heart is racing and your thoughts are whirling inside your head, your effectiveness just plummets. But if you'll pause right in the middle of all the hubbub, maybe close your eyes, breathe deeply, and remind yourself that the current task will be completed, you'll feel an immediate sense of relief. Then you can head back into the job at hand with renewed focus and energy. And when the next chance comes to overcommit, it comes your way, you can work on your priorities by just saying, "Hey, no." Well, welcome back to the Dr. Linda Mintel Show with special guest psychiatrist Dr. Kurt Thompson, whose website is beingknown.com and who authored the book The Soul of Shame. And shame is our topic today. We're not trying to shame you. We're trying to help you deal with shame. And so we were talking a lot about how shame works. Before we went to the break, you were talking about how we have to be in community with each other in order to heal from shame. Let's talk more about how that happens and what that looks like.
This is a story that I tell in the book. I met with a young woman once who presented in our office. She was in her early 30s, and she was an attorney, and she was in a fairly high-powered law firm where she was doing work that she was really good at. And she originally came to see me because she couldn't sleep, and she was anxious, and that's really all that she wanted. She wanted a way to fix her sleeping problem. As part of the normal psychiatric evaluation, we ask all kinds of questions about all kinds of things. And eventually we got around to the question of how her marriage was. And she didn't think that that was necessarily important. As fate would have it, before you know it, she blurted out, "I'm having an affair with my boss." And of course, she was just incredulous that she had just said that. And she couldn't believe that she'd said it. And of course, immediately became tearful, stopped talking. And the story was that this person had developed a great skill in her particular role, but as she had done this after having had children, the one place in her life where she was getting really great feedback, great compensation in terms of not just being paid, but in terms of accolades and so forth, was in her work. But before you knew it, it was also working with a man, her boss at the firm, who himself was in a troubled marriage, and one thing led to another. She had an affair. I said, "You know, I'll be happy to talk with you more about your sleep and give you something to help you sleep, but you're going to have to come back and talk about this." Reluctantly, she did. And of course, at some point in the conversation, it raises the question, well, at what point are you going to tell your husband about what's going on? The long and the short of it is that she eventually did, but she was terrified to do so. She was certain that when she did, her husband would leave, he would take the kids, and so forth. This notion that her shame was the thing that was not just keeping her from telling her husband about the affair, it was the thing that was fueling the ongoing action in the affair in the first place. When she told her husband, it was the first step toward regeneration. But of course, you can imagine, in the day that they met in my office, and this was going to be the thing that she told him, everything about her physiologically, emotionally, was just overwhelmingly distraught. Now, we come to find out, and this is true in every marriage, that no one partner is solely responsible for rebuilding a marriage once an affair has happened. And so one of the things that we do in our practice is that we have groups for women and for men, the explicit purpose for which is for them to be deeply known by the other women and men in those groups. And so in addition to having them in marriage therapy, they each were part of a group. Her husband and she became parts of groups in which the explicit purpose was for them to practice telling the whole story about who they are. Now, most of us don't have people but I would suggest to us, Linda, like, this is what the church
is supposed to
is essentially to be about. We see this in AA, essentially.
But it's a trust factor, isn't it, Kurt? I mean, we don't trust each other to tell our deepest feelings and things that are going on with us because we're not sure what people are going to do with that, first of all.
Right, exactly. We don't trust each other because shame is at work. I've been part of a group. There are three other men that I've been meeting with for the past 20 years, once a week for prayer and confession. And I can tell you that if I don't have these guys, I'm a dead man. I'm frequently asked this question, well, Kurt, I can't go out and find it, but how am I going to find these groups?
Right.
It's important for us to know that when the writer of the Hebrews talks about shame in the 12th chapter when he recognizes what Jesus did to scorn shame, that whole passage begins with this notion of, now that we have such a great cloud of witnesses, we can then throw off the sin that entangles us, that we can persevere, that we can fix our eyes on Jesus, who is leading us and who has taught us how to scorn shame. Mm-hmm. Practically speaking, it's important for us, first of all, to ask the question, who is included in that great cloud of witnesses? Who are the two or three or half dozen people by whom I am being deeply known? These are not easy things to do, but these must be done in order for us to continue to grow spiritually in our vitality and to work against shame.
I think this is so hard, though, because I think, who are those people that you can trust, that you can bring into your circle? I hear this all the time. It's one of the reasons why people say, I'm paying you to be my therapist, because I know that you will keep my confidence, that I can trust you, and that I can tell you anything, and you're not going to leave me, and you're not going to abandon me, which is exactly what Jesus says to us. Tell me everything. I'm not going to leave you or abandon you. I get what you're saying. How do we become that for each other, I guess, is
right.
The issue.
Well, I think in that passage in Hebrews, when it says, fix our eyes on Jesus, that tells me that I need to see what he does, mm-hmm. and do what he does. Mm-hmm. And I would say the reality is that Jesus was faced with the same dilemma. Mm-hmm. When he shows up on the planet, he's a one-man band. But we would say later on, this is Trinitarian theology, that Jesus, in the power of the Spirit,
right.
with the voice of his Father in his ear,
right.
has to take the same risks we do.
Right.
He has to walk into a world and he says, who am I going to trust? Right. I find 12 dudes,
yeah.
one of whom is going to throw me under the bus.
Yeah.
It's important to know, if we're going to be like Jesus,
mm-hmm.
which is what it means for us
mm-hmm.
to be formed
mm-hmm.
in the image of Christ, if we're going to be like Jesus, we have to do what he did, which means, yes, it is hard. It is hard to find, because being a believer is hard to do. But we live in a culture that tells
yeah.
us that everything should be easy,
yeah.
including following Jesus. This
yeah.
shouldn't be hard. Crucifixion, I don't really take that seriously. Being stripped naked and nailed to a piece of wood, that's not really what this should be about.
Mm.
But in fact, if I'm going to put all of that to death, if I'm really going to put shame to death, it's going to require the kind of hard work that will be harder than anything else we do mm. in our life. To the degree that we are intent upon praying for this, seeking this out, taking the risk of finding those communal members with whom I can then be in connection with, we can find the kind of freedom and regeneration for our relationships, for within our own lives, as this couple that I'm talking about found in their marriage. That work that they did, it was Herculean. It was overwhelmingly difficult. It took 4 years at least before they could turn around and say, we're really glad for all the work that we've done. Mm. We wouldn't want the affair to have happened,
right.
but we aren't sorry about the work that we have been able to do. But it was a monstrously hard mountain for them to climb. But I would suggest that that's part of what our culture would like for us to believe, that following Jesus, being people of God, working to help usher in his kingdom of goodness and beauty, shouldn't be that difficult.
Hmm.
But moving mountains takes
yeah.
a great deal of work.
Yeah, and definitely a partnership with Christ. Great words. We're going to do more about shame in the last segment, ways that we can deal with this in our own spiritual formation. So stay with us. We'll be back after the break with Dr. Kurt Thompson. Mother and daughter relationships are powerful, and they impact all our other relationships. Think about it. The way you react with your mom typically is the way you might react with other people. Yet this important bond can be filled with tension when both women try to find their own voice and develop a sense of self. So working through the mother-daughter relationship can be a challenge, but it is so worth the effort. Hi, I'm Dr. Linda Mintel, and I would love to help you navigate this important relationship and strengthen it to the best it can be. That's why I wrote I Love My Mother, But, a book to strengthen the mother-daughter relationship. We all love our mothers, but sometimes we need a little help working through our differences. I Love My Mother, But, available on my website, drlindamintel.com, or online where books are sold.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Dr. Linda Mental Show with my special guest today, Dr. Kurt Thompson, and we're discussing his book, The Soul of Shame. And you can get that book where books are sold online. You could also go to his website, beingknown.com. So I'd encourage you to do that. There's so much more than what we're going to be able to talk about. We're just scratching the surface. We were talking during the break, Dr. Thompson, about the person who's listening and going, sounds great. I wish the body of Christ would be there for me. I wish I could find this person who I could have that kind of relationship where I can be known to that person in all aspects of who I am. What are your suggestions for somebody who's feeling a little discouraged about that right now?
It's a great question, Linda. It makes sense that a person would feel discouraged because we don't live in a world often, even within the church, where we have naturally formed pathways whereby which we can see this come to fruition. I do have a couple of concrete things that we can do. I will often tell patients who are asking me the same question, you can go to your pastor, and I understand that not even all pastors are dialed into this, but I would suggest go to your pastor and say, I am really interested in being more deeply known. I want to be more confessional. I want to have a couple of other people in my life with whom I can walk deeply in my faith. Could you give me the names of a couple of people that you think would be open to doing this kind of work? Now, at the risk of sounding shamelessly self-promotional, some people have given pastors the book, The Soul of Shame, as a way to kind of introduce that topic, as a way to give the pastors an idea of what we're talking about doing. And if the pastor were to give you a couple of names, one of the things that you can do is read the book together. That's one way to do it, so that you have a mechanism whereby which all the parties involved have something that's providing a bit of a guide for that.
Yeah.
So that one person isn't wading in and feeling like I have to open up all my dirty laundry for someone who might throw me under the bus the next day.
Right.
Once you have a couple of people in your circle, you can begin by, first of all, just talking about what it is that you hope to do, talking about why you're afraid to do it. Before you reveal particularly shaming things, you can reveal the fact that I'm a little worried about talking about what I'm ashamed of.
Yeah.
We like to say in the business that you start hard conversations at the end.
Yeah.
We say, I'm afraid that when we get done having this conversation, either today or in 10 years, you're going to find out something about me and you're going to want nothing more
to do with me.
And it's really quite striking when we start those hard conversations at the end, how disarming that approach can be.
And well, so, a lot of people will come into therapy with that. Dr. Mental, if I tell you what I'm really thinking, if I tell you what is really going on with me, you're not going to want to see me as a patient and you're not going to like me very much.
Exactly.
And it's at the heart of somebody who has an eating disorder. I hear that over and over and over.
Exactly.
And yet you're saying that's exactly what we need to begin our conversation with and get some trust going and some commitment to, I'm here with you and I will commit to keeping this confidential, or I will commit to keeping it in our own little circle here.
Right. What's interesting is that even that small step creates a beachhead.
Yeah.
Even that small step is a step of trust.
Yeah, it is.
To even say to you, I'm afraid that I might tell you something that you'll walk away from, I'm telling you that I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And if in that moment you're able to say, I get that, I understand, and I want you not to be afraid, so let's try. And then the next step, once we've established that, okay, we're willing to try this, the next thing I say to folks is, you don't have to wade in with your deepest, darkest secret. We can start to tell stories with which we have some modicum of confidence. We are naked beings. We put clothes on to cover our nakedness, but that doesn't make us any less naked in reality.
Yeah.
Well, we like to say that the man and the woman were naked and unashamed, Genesis 2:25. It points to God's intention that the most powerful acts of creativity that human beings engage in take place in a context in which we are naked, in which we are vulnerable. And unashamed, in which we are vulnerable and in which shame is not part of that process. When we come together and reveal, when we are naked, when we are vulnerable with one another, we create opportunity for the Holy Spirit to take those conversations and create great change in both the speaker and the listener. Because as I speak my shame, the listener is made more confident that they too can share their shame, their fears with me. As this goes along, we then are going to find that over time, there are going to be bumps in the road.
Sure.
But with practice, we make more permanent these bonds of connection with mm-hmm. each other in such a way that it further establishes our capacity for shame to be healed.
When you're talking about this, I'm thinking just what you said. This was God's original intention with his creation.
That's right.
And then sin came into it and disrupted that unashamed bond.
That's right.
And then you're saying that now we need to work on not only that in our relationship with God, so sort of the vertical relationship with God, where we are naked before him, whether we recognize it or not. But as we do that with God, then to have the courage to do that with each other, because he brought the woman with the man.
Right.
So he obviously gave us these human people that we're supposed to also develop that bond. And we, you know, we've all heard the pastors talk about how marriage is a sacred covenant, and this is very much this oneness that is the closest thing you're probably going to get to God. Having these relationships with other people where we can develop that kind of trust and intimacy. What you're talking about is what we would do with a friend who might be very close, what we would do with an intimate other in our relationship, in a marriage.
Right.
And even the kind of bond that we would develop with our children.
Exactly.
Over time. So
exactly.
This is not just practice because you have a problem.
Right.
This is practice because this is what deepens our relationships with each other.
The healing of shame is not just about helping relationships,
mm-hmm.
and it is not primarily about my feeling better about myself.
Mm-hmm.
We need to recognize that evil's intention in Genesis mm-hmm. 3 is not to disrupt relationships. It is to destroy the creation.
Yes.
It is to destroy everything.
Yeah.
And part of what we were created to do was to also create as God creates.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that evil does in wielding shame is it disrupts our capacity to create vocationally. The next most powerful outcome of shame's healing is that we are invited to become aware of vocational domains of calling that we don't know about because they have for so long been buried under miles of earth of shame.
Wow.
As we are in these healing communities, as we like to call them, we aren't just brought to places of relational wholeness. We are also literally unleashed vocationally in multiple domains to become things that we before that could never even have imagined.
And that's what true freedom looks like.
Indeed.
We're going to have to leave it at that, and hopefully we'll be able to bring Dr. Thompson back at another time. Many thanks to our producer, Pam Miller, our engineer, Chris Underation, our social media director, Cody Gokenauer, and special thanks to you, my guest, Dr. Kurt Thompson, who made the show a conversation. From all of us here at Faith Radio, we'll talk to you next weekend. In the meantime, remember, we're here, we're doing life together, and it's better when you don't have to do it alone.
The Dr. Linda Mental Show is a production of WQLU-FM 90.9 in Lynchburg, Virginia.